product not yet rated. Welcome to the Lost Pages of Norse Myth. I'm Jason Weiser, your narrator and host of the Myths and Legends podcast. Each month, join us here as we reveal a missing page from the Prose Edda, the ancient manuscript containing all of Norse myth. It's whispered that these lost pages tell the story of a mysterious god from a distant land and his young son as they embark on a perilous journey across the Norse realms. I present now the second lost page, Odin and the Knowledge Keeper. Perhaps this one, she thought, as she blew the dust from the cover. At long last, perhaps this one will let me see far enough to catch a glimpse of my lost love, my husband. Groa, the seer, inspected the tome that she had just discovered. This was the one she had been hunting for quite some time. Cracking open the tome, she allowed herself a slight smile, knowing that the runes inside held the power to augment her already substantial prophetic talents, and perhaps allow her to, after all this time, glimpse the location of her husband, Arvandil. Groa's search for her lost husband had been ongoing now for some time. Already a gifted seer, she hoped to lengthen the scope of her sight by hunting down and collecting tomes of arcane wisdom. She had traversed the realms, hunting for such tomes, each one full of ancient knowledge. And, with each runic passage spoken aloud, her powers of sight did grow. But she never glimpsed what she was truly after, the location of Arvandil. The last time Groa had felt her husband's embrace was moments before he journeyed on a quest by the side of Thor, the mighty son of Odin. Arvandil had never returned from that quest. All Groa knew was that, after suffering from a bout of frostbite, Thor attempted to carry Arvandil home from Vanaheim, across a bitter and icy stream, in a basket on his back. But somewhere in the tundra, Thor lost Arvandil. Thor returned home with only an empty basket. He knew not what fate befell Groa's true love. Although her sought-after prize continued to elude her, Groa did glimpse many things inside each tome. Soon, the search for her husband became a pursuit for knowledge itself, and over the years, Groa had collected her discoveries in an endless library of arcane wisdom. As her powers grew, so did her reputation for prophecy. Even one so powerful as Thor's father, Odin, the Allfather, came to rely on Groa's foresight. Groa didn't know why, but back in the safety of her library, she felt that this latest tome was somehow special. Her prophecies had grown to allow her to see longer and farther than anyone before or since, and she felt this latest tome would surely tip the scales of her talents to allow her to see what she so desperately desired. And now that she held it in her hands, she could crack it open, recite the runic incantations inside, and claim the tome's power for herself. Groa lifted the book's cover and spoke the runic phrases aloud, her voice echoing with lingering hope and divine magic. As she spoke the runes aloud, she shut her eyes tight, her mind flooded with images. But the whereabouts of poor Arvandil didn't come with the flood. Instead, Groa grimaced as her mind raced with horrible, disastrous visions. She saw the worlds plunge into a bitter, three-year winter. She saw the sky split, and the realms began to tremble and quake. She saw a horrible terror emerge with a flaming sword and an enormous, beastly wolf rampaging across the countryside as he grew to consume the very sun. She saw the deadliest of monsters and the worst of gods at each other's throats. And, in the events leading up to it all, she also saw a pale, white ghost from a distant land and his young son, somehow intertwined in this terrible prophecy. Back in Asgard, realm of the Aesir gods, Odin's remaining eye twitched. He felt the ripples of Groa's prophecy come crashing across the realms. Ragnarok, Odin whispered to himself with a tremble, and then, lifting himself from his throne, the Allfather hissed, Groa. Still reeling from the onslaught of her terrible vision, Groa steadied herself against her library walls. She had seen so much, too much, and still, the fate of her beloved Arvandil remained a mystery. How can this be? she lamented out loud. Were Arvandil's whereabouts so hidden, so secret, that even she who had glimpsed the end of all things was still unable to divine his location? Or did he remain hidden because someone was hiding him? Yes, thought Groa, but what creature would be so ruthless as to cloud her own husband from her sight? Groa didn't have time to wallow in a revelation for long. Moments later, she heard a beckoning call from outside her library's front door. She strained against the heavy door and saw him there. Odin, the Allfather. This was not abnormal. Odin had visited Groa's library many times, seeking her prophetic knowledge. He was most likely here in an attempt to avoid some minor ill fate. Allfather, your presence honors me, Groa started, but now is not the best time. Groa's excuse was cut short, as Odin's hand clasped hard around her throat. The skies darkened with growing gray clouds. He drew her near and demanded, Seer, tell me what you've seen. Odin, Groa stammered. Tell me, said the Allfather, or I shall bash your head in, just like my son Thor did to your beloved Arvando. Now, Groa understood. In all of her travels, in all her collections of arcane wisdom, the reason she was still yet unable to glimpse the fate of her husband was because Odin had used his enchantments to conceal his death at Thor's hands from her sight. She struggled against Odin's mighty grip, defiant not to tell him of her visions of Ragnarok, or of the strange god from another land. But it mattered not. With a smile, Odin tightened his grip and took Groa's knowledge, her runes, her vast library, and her very life for his own. The second lost page of Norse myth has been revealed, but you can uncover more runic secrets this month by following PlayStation and God of War on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Decipher the ancient runes and speak them aloud by sharing them, and we might reveal some epic visions of the world of God of War. Now, stay tuned for a behind-the-scenes chat with God of War's creative director, Corey Barlog, and Matt Sophos, story lead, on the power of runes and building the runic language for God of War's ancient Norse worlds.
To start, will you introduce yourself and talk about your role on God of War?
My name is Corey Barlog, and I am the director on this new God of War thing.
I'm Matt Sophos. I am the story lead.
Okay, so first, I want to talk about the runes. Can you give us an overview of the concept of runes in Norse mythology and how they're important to the God of War game?
So the runes are sort of the basic alphabet. They have both kind of like an individual metaphorical meaning, a larger meaning to them, as well as kind of the phonetic alphabet connection. And then in our game, we're using them as a way to kind of connect the characters to the magic of the world, but also I think just really connect to the world to kind of create that sense of a barrier between the player, who is Kratos, and the world, right? That kind of feeling that you've entered a world is very different than anything that you're familiar with.
Yeah, we're playing probably a little more fast and loose with the chronology of things. The runes are, you know, we're in kind of the pre-migration period of that kind of that era. But the runes for us is language. It's kind of throughout the world. In the real world nowadays, you can find kind of graffiti on rocks and stuff like that, and we make use of that as well, so that you'll see runes in the world. Everything we kind of do in the world is real. It's not just gibberish. We don't just throw runes up for decoration as much as possible. It's language. It's the way that people communicated with each other. So.
We're giant word nerds, and we believe that the words have power. So it's nice to kind of put that in the world itself to not only empower the characters, so that most magic in this world begins with the speaking of a specific word within the sort of ancient language, but even sort of things within the world. The sun is Kratos' conduit. Atreus is his conduit into this world because he can actually read the language. which, you know, totally ripped off from my own life of my kid who is learning Swedish, totally understands more than I do. And my relatives during E3 were here, and everyone's speaking Swedish, and he's understanding everything, but also will speak a little bit of English because he knows I'm not following any of the stuff that they're saying. It was deliberately something I think we said we wanted to make part of the mechanics, so that as you go through the game, the son is learning more of the language, and we're even tying that into the Atreus trying to teach his dad a little bit about it, right? The old dog learning a few new tricks, but it kind of has that fun sense of true discovery for a player to feel like a language that they couldn't understand early on is suddenly sort of opening itself up and giving you information. It's the Zelda thing when you go to see the Master Sword and all the question marks are on the text message. And then as you progress through, it's like, oh, I'm understanding a little bit of this. And then eventually you understand what that message is telling you. It feels like there's this great sense of discovery, this feeling of unearthing a mystery. And I think that's fantastic. That's so games.
We have a couple different kinds of magic that our characters will do in the game. One, like say their magic, is a very earthy component to it that involves touching the ground and using parts of the. It's very kind of dirty magic. That sounded terrible. That sounds dirty terrible. Magic.
It's dirty magic.
Dirty magic. But that, as well as the other kind of magic, like the magic that you've seen in trailers and things like that we have that the son can do. It all involves a word. It all involves a spoken incantation and stuff as well. And that involves that's language, and our language is Elder Futhark. So.
Okay. How did you approach creating the runic alphabet for God of War?
We totally just stole the Elder Futhark. No, I mean, we wanted to maintain a connection to the sort of cultural history of this mythology. And the Elder Futhark is a very established alphabet, right? And there are 9 realms, and I think there are other sort of proposed or theorized languages associated with those realms. But really, the Elder Futhark is kind of that connection to, you can say, A is this rune, you know, TH is this rune. And you can kind of always connect it back and translate things. So that in our game, everything that's on the walls, we actually translate it first to Old Norse, and then take that Old Norse and then translate that to the Elder Futhark, so that whatever's written on the wall is not just English with old runes, it's actually translated into Old Norse.
Yeah, which... we try not to take the shortcut and go just kind of English to runes, because, you know, that leaves out a massive part of our audience to get on the hunt for what does each little thing say in the world. So it makes it harder for everybody, because, except for, I guess, Icelandic people, because that's the closest thing we got. I guess I'm expecting lots of websites from Iceland where they translate all the stuff in our game.
Right, they're leading the
path. But yeah, that's the path, right? We figure out what they want to say. We do our damnedest to translate it correctly. A lot of times I'm doing the translation, or one of our implementers was doing the translation, so it's probably going to be a lot like Pigeon English, but Pigeon Icelandic? Pigeon Old Icelandic? Because it's not modern Icelandic, it's the Old Icelandic, so we're doing our best. And then it goes into runes and on the wall. So it's going to be quite the deciphering challenge, I think.
So you mentioned the other realms. How did you develop the languages for those?
That was a combination of one of our artists and a few of us talking. We did a trip to Iceland with the art director and several other people. I think Shannon Sutsil even went to that one. And it was a kind of a look at the landscapes, and to get a sense of what this world was like, how that sort of region of the world feels. But while they were there, they found this book, and the name unfortunately escapes me at this point, but it has a red cover, so you know that I'm telling the truth. And inside that, someone had sort of, I don't know if they themselves created it or were theorizing that this was connected, but they had created languages not only for certain races like the dwarves, but they had created languages for Helheim and a few other of the realms. They had not had languages for all the realms, but I looked at it and I said, oh, that's really cool, because it gives us a little bit more freedom to say, we're actually theorizing languages for each of these realms. And then kind of doing sort of the Rosetta Stone connection and saying, this rune connects to this rune, so that while Elder Futhark is your base language, you will translate then every other language into this. And we sort of just leaned into that super heavy so that we're not doing it for every single realm. We're kind of leaving certain things open to kind of expand out. But there are certain realms that you will learn their entire language and then translate that back. And that might help open parts of the game, reveal a quest line for something.
So are all the languages in the U.S. edition of God of War spoken in English? Or
early on, I wanted to go full bore, like Mel Gibson's original vision for passion, in that sense of like everybody speaking the ancient Norse. Nobody speaks to him. And then when they talk to him, Atreus is the only one that can then say, this is what he just said. So the player is truly isolated from really everyone. And even the friendly people, nobody speaks a localized language. But it proved to be, I think, too difficult to kind of carry the narrative that we want to carry, because you're really so isolated that it just becomes totally separated. And anytime the kid is not standing right next to you to translate anything, you're like, oh, this is not as fun. So we find a nice mixture between the two in the end result. So I think that's good. And also we want to challenge the voice actors, because it's so fun to hear them try to pronounce some of these things. I mean, we can't pronounce. I mean, we take somebody else like giving us a audio recordings of the proper pronunciations, because it is just... Sometimes I'll just go home and point to something to my wife and say, "What? How do I say this?" and have her say it like six times, and then I repeat it back, and I'm like, I forget it the next day anyway.
So you mentioned Kratos being a stranger in a strange land, like where he knows nothing of the customs, people, surroundings. Why was it important to set him in unfamiliar surroundings?
I think because we're going so vastly different with this game, we wanted to kind of put everybody on equal footing. You know, that if you played the game or if you haven't played the game, to be able to step in and feel like, look, we're all equally confused. We're all equally sort of having to discover, so that if you've played, you get a little bit of like, oh, I understand that little inside joke, or I understand a little bit more about the motivations here. But even if you haven't played, you kind of discover as you go. Some of the motivations was that, you know, I didn't want any camera cuts in this game because I wanted everybody to approach each situation having the same amount of information. There is no, and previously, this character was doing this in an unseen location, so that when you meet him, you're like, I saw your backstory shot. I know what this really means. You have to just take every situation on its face value and then read into it. You know, I was watching reaction videos from the trailer for E3 this year, and it was funny the number of people who doubted the intentions of the serpent at the end of the trailer. So it's like you watch that and they're like, you know, ooh, this is the boss. And then he wants to help us. He wants to help us. What? Uh-uh. That's why he doesn't want to help you. Uh-uh. I don't trust him.
Snake.
I don't trust him, man.
You can't trust
like,
a snake.
Yeah. And it's like one guy, he's like, I don't like snakes. So I don't trust him. But then other people were saying like, I just don't trust him. And it's like, that's interesting. And that is human. That is when you meet somebody for the first time and you are in the situations that they're in, which is, there's a 50-50 shot it's going to be hostile. In fact, in this world, it's probably like a 70-30 shot that the confrontation is going to be hostile, right? The Hall of Rising has a great sequence where he meets that group of people. And, you know, there is a huge possibility that that's going to end in a fight. And then they end up like, let's drink and eat together. And it's, you know, that it could have gone both ways at any point in that confrontation. And I think it's very interesting when you put somebody in a situation where they not only don't know the hostile intentions of the person across from them, they cannot understand the language. And then they are relying on this little kid, right? Who actually is smarter than them. So you take somebody like Kratos, who's a strong god, who shouldn't need anybody else, right? A lot of people say, oh, well, what's the point? Why do you have the kid? He doesn't need anybody. But I think that's the fascinating point, is taking the intellectual side and saying, look, he is not Plato. He is not this sort of scholar who sought out information. He really is this warrior who is now trying to turn over a sort of a different life. And part of that is, I'm living in an area where you kind of have to help me through this. Someone else has to be the strong one, but a strong one in a different way, right? And then you got to start wondering, is he telling me the truth? Is he giving me all the information? It's like when you watch those movies and they don't do the subtitles for a sequence because a character in the scene is going to translate it. And you're like, I don't know if he's telling me everything. Like, I wonder, did he give me the exact info? And then later you find out sometimes they didn't. They kind of withheld. It's that Planescape Torment thing.
I think it having that Kratos in a strange land, it puts us right in the pocket of the story that we really want to tell with Kratos. It allows us to, he's a guy who all he ever wanted to do is forget all the terrible stuff he did. So now he goes to a completely different land and, he can't forget it, but he doesn't have to dwell on it. And just like you're saying, he doesn't necessarily know if something that someone is telling him is the complete truth or it's the complete, if it's the complete story that they're reading or whatever. But it's a flip on Kratos because Kratos has his secrets. And so there's a lot of interplay between telling half-truths, I think.
So what power or skills does this give Atreus? Like, are the runes part of the magic system in God of War?
Yeah, there's a couple different things that Atreus can do. There's obviously the reading stuff in the world, but there's puzzles that involve reading runes. And basically translating those runes to Kratos, and sometimes Kratos has to make kind of a decision, and the player has to make the decision on what to do with it. And it's also involved in the combats in the combat system. The kid has runes kind of tattooed on him by the mother. The mother was someone who taught the kid magic, and all of that involves language. I think we kind of talked about that before.
Yeah, that language kind of imbuing the person with power so that not only the speaking of it, but tattooing things on their body, you know, sometimes will hide them from the gods. It will give them a truer aim or a clearer head. This sort of connection that not only did like symbology, like staves, the sort of practice of magical they're not runes, they're more like drawings, symbols, yeah. Symbols, that's what I'm going to call them now. Symbology is what I meant to say, but then stopped and said symbols, so fantastic. Those things would again, give you luck. There is one that apparently if you put it on a pair of pants...
That's right, yes.
Made of the skin of your enemy, right? It will make the pockets full of gold.
Yeah.
Every night. It's really bizarre. Like, there's some crazy, bizarre stuff in Norse mythology. It is one of the most labyrinthian, confusing mythologies that I've ever looked into.
Staves are a whole other aspect. They're similar to runes and how we deal with runes, but staves of protection, staves of hiding, things like that. Those are also elements in the game that we deal with, and sometimes the staves themselves have runes in them. So.
So Atreus knows the runes. Does he also know Norse history and Norse mythology, or have knowledge of the world that Kratos doesn't?
He knows everything that the mother taught him. So okay. There are things that the mother has conveyed to him. So Atreus will be able to recognize a Draugr, but he's never actually fought a Draugr or anything like that. So he's got kind of. He's got a base understanding. He a lot of times in the game you'll hear him say, "Well, mother told me," but the experience of it, experiencing it himself, it creates a whole other context for him. We have a couple different things where there's an item in the game that you can access, and Kratos kind of opens it up for him, and the kid gets little pieces of story, and he recalls bits that mother talked to him about, but this is a little bit more of a complete picture because, just like anything else. The mother has her own perspective. Kratos has her own perspective. And so all that the kid knows of the stories,
not revealing yet that he's a woman.
Correct. all that the kid knows is what the mother has taught him, right?
It's that coming of age of the child where fantasy meets reality inside of fantasy, right? That he knows the world. Through stories, through the limited teachings, they are these sort of esoteric concepts, these fantastic stories told by firelight. But as he then leaves the protection of his forest, he has lived for his entire childhood in a very small bubble in this forest. They've never ventured beyond because they were very safe in this one area. But when he goes out into the real world and starts encountering the things that were told to him in stories, the things that existed only in his mind's eye in sort of a descriptive form, the reality slaps him in the face, and it causes this sort of sobering wake up, right?
His opinions evolve.
Yeah, his opinions change. And he also becomes the conduit to Kratos of saying, like, look, this is sort of what mom said, but we're experiencing slightly differently. Or no, I can make this connection because of this connection. And it helps at least inform certain things. But Kratos also knows a little bit. He's able to kind of piece things together from his previous experiences. His experiences are colored with the Greek gods, right? Who are the bastard politicians who manipulated all the humans. So to him, that's what these gods have to be. But he's starting to discover that these gods are vastly different. The creatures of this world, the gods of this world, very, very different from the Greek gods.
Yeah, Kratos makes a lot of assumptions in the game.
And it's all founded by that base in Greek mythology and the experiences he had then. And obviously he was a very different person then too. But all of that colors his perspective. So anytime he might run across, a Norse creature or a Norse god or something like that, everything's colored by his past experiences. And the sun can go, wait, like in the trailer, right? With the world serpent, Kratos is ready to go. You know, he's expecting, okay, well, it's a big thing. I'm going to have to fight it. Much like how the players felt, right. You know, previous players felt when they watched that trailer. And the kid is the one who could give him the perspective of, no, he's okay.
That's that balance of the humanity and the sort of God, right? That he lost long ago, the humanity, and it eroded from the end of the first game all the way to the most recent. And now he's on this path of understanding the balance. And the kid really is almost pure humanity, right? And zero God. And you see the change in him when you inject a little bit of that, the God in there, and realize how it fundamentally changes them. And Kratos sees a bit of his own past, the beginnings of that unraveling of his life.
I'm just curious, you mentioned the comparisons between the Greek gods to the Norse gods. How are they different in God of War?
For me, I kind of look at it as, you know, the Greek gods were the well-manicured politicians, right? Imagine the politicians today with their Washington power walls of photos of them with the presidents and the dignitaries all across the world, and manicured to a T, expensive suits, mahogany desks. Everything's all about the impression of power. But really what they're doing is manipulating others in order to fulfill a specific agenda that they have. They're not really getting down into the muck, right? They're not there fighting. They're simply there saying, I'm going to send you over to do this. And that's the Greek gods. They were basically using all of humanity and everyone else, even other gods, as pawns in these sort of larger games, right? But they were wearing shiny armor, living in marble palaces that were just the height of ostentatiousness. But the gods in Norse mythology are a bit more down to earth, is one way to say of it. Like, as I was reading through a lot of this, I started getting comparisons to like the three races of the Aesir, the Vanir, and the Giants. The Aesir to me were like Hunter S. Thompson's portrayal of the Hell's Angels, right? They are the dirtiest sort of knockdown, drag out, fight, like get drunk, enjoy every moment of life, and just pride themselves on this, right?
Because they were just best in life,
right? There you go, and it literally is like that portrayal of Conan as well. That they are just living every moment to its fullest because they know they're going to die. They know who's going to kill them. Mm-hmm. They know when it's going to happen. So to them, they're just like, live it up, man. Just party all you want. And to them, partying is fighting and drinking and feasting. This is sort of a very hedonistic society. And the Vanir are kind of, the crude way to put it is the naturals or the hippies, right? They are living in harmony with nature. They want to seek that balance. They are the sort of keepers of the magic and sort of that one hand on the natural, one hand on the magical, and feeling like there is a fusion between these two. And they're always sort of at war with the bikers simply because they have different agendas on how they want to solve things. And to me, the Giants are vastly different than the sort of Marvel and other portrayals of this. They are the masons. They are the artists, right? They are the people who are creating these fantastic creations, the ones who look a little deeper at what's going on, the ones who are eventually victimized by a war that seems to never end between the Vanir and the Aesir gods, right? So this sort of layout feels vastly different than one of the gods because they're not really there to manipulate, though Odin always kind of, I think, parallels Zeus. You know, there's a lot of connections to that. Zeus came in many forms, and throughout history, all the people sort of theorizing or analyzing the Eddas kind of have, what, 170 names for Odin? Yeah, he comes in it's ridiculous, dude. It makes it impossible to try to connect anything because you're realizing, like, everything has 50 meanings to it, and every character could be 20 different characters, so you never know what is real and what is not, but in one way, that's actually the coolest part of it. It's frustrating for me, but liberating at the same time, because everything is very malleable. It is water. This mythology is very much, like, taking the form of different containers as it moves through the interpretations of scholars.
There's such clear texts
to reference for Greek mythology, like texts from the period of time. Whereas what we have for Norse mythology is essentially 600 years after the fact, or actually, I think even longer than that after
filtered
the fact.
Filtered through different cultures.
I think, you know, the prose Edda, all that kind of stuff.
And through time, right?
Through time.
Also the sort of trying to eliminate paganism.
Right.
There was a lot of Christians who were changing the mythology.
Rosetta was written by a Christian.
Or like the wedding of Thor, where it's like they put him in a dress. Yes. Yeah.
That's a good one.
Was that the one where he dresses up in a dress to get the hammer back?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it is just filled with bizarre moments like that. That when you, I don't know, it feels like part of it is a bizarre sense of humor, sort of a very dry sense of humor of like injecting their witticisms within this. But then the others where you're just like Loki turns into a horse to have sex with another horse to distract him in order to then give birth to another horse, which they give to Odin. It's like that.
My favorite is the tying the balls to a goat story.
Oh, the balls to a goat is very good. That's a classic, right? Like that's the symbology that I was talking about.
Nice. Good callback.
Cyclical.
Okay, so wrapping up, how can players prepare ahead of time? Should we be studying Elder of Futhark? And are there Easter eggs hidden in the game?
I don't know about early preparation. You know, it's fun to read about these myths, but it's definitely not necessary because everything we do kind of will be explained as you move through the game.
I guess bone up on old Icelandic.
Yeah. You know, learn conversational ancient Icelandic.
Will it be possible to translate the runes in the game? Do they have meaning, ones that you see?
Any runes that look like actual readable runes will mean something. We do have other areas where it's like they've been eroded away or they're so small you can't read them. Those are ones that are just the decorative that are around. But every single thing that we've made obvious and clear that you see, their Elder Futhark or other sort of runes from another realm, all of that will be able to be translated and it will mean something. Sometimes we don't let you translate it in the game. Like there's stuff in the first E3 demo that is all over the walls that actually means something, and we don't tell you what that means. So a lot of people had done screen grabs to say, this is what this word means, right? Because we also didn't tell them that we went to ancient Norse. So a lot of people would just translate Elder Futhark into English, and it was like, oh, this is gibberish.
Yeah.
But if they went to an ancient Norse and then went to their native language, they would understand the word.
Yeah, so there throughout the game, there are things that the player can use the dedicated sun button on to read specific things. That's all as legit as this American guy can make it. But it's as legit as we can go. And then there's also stuff that you don't actually send the kid to read, but it's legible. It means something. And it, if you want to take the time to translate it, then you certainly can.
And we're giant nerds. So seriously, I've hid so much stuff in this game and everybody really gets into kind of coming up with these things to hide inside the game. So there isn't much associated with this game that doesn't have multiple secrets in it. I'm talking about literally everything we're going to do. All of our E3 trailers have things hidden inside them. The first one has a lot more than the second one, but the second one still has a bunch of stuff in there. And the game is no different. Everything associated with it also has hidden meaning.
Well, as the last question, the God of War Ouroboros seems derived from the Greek Omega symbol from previous games. There are several specific runes in the logo. Can you tell us what their significance is?
I absolutely cannot. It actually has meaning. We very deliberately, when we started looking at the logo, were kind of thinking about, my idea was that when we went between the different eras, I'm calling them, the mythologies, we would have the consistency of the God of War font, right? The God of War logo, which you get a little bit of a treatment change, but then the symbology at the center, the Omega, was very Greek, right? It was very much the portent of the end of the Greek pantheon. And this symbology in Norse myth was using the world serpent, right? And the choice of each of the runes and their arrangement definitely has a connection to the overall narrative thrust, and I think even exploration thrust of the game. But specifically, we're not getting into what that is.
And some of them in the World Serpent logo are, some of the runes are actually flipped if you look at them, and there's reason for that as well.
Oh yeah, it basically just spells out Corey is the master of the runes. Again, it's awesome.
That's what you think it says,
right?
It says Corey something,
right? Why. It's like that tattoo that just says soup, but it's supposed to say power. Yeah.
All right, well, Corey and Matt, thank you so much for sitting down. The game looks awesome. I love the depth and the complexity of it all. So looking forward to it.
Yeah.